Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're tackling a topic that's central to many faiths and belief systems, miracles.
Definitely a big one.
For a huge number of people, especially in Christianity, the concept of the miraculous is absolutely key. I mean, the resurrection of Jesus Christ is really the ultimate foundational event.
Right, the cornerstone claim.
But of course, the idea stretches far beyond that. You know, think about the stories in the Old Testament, the parting of the Red Sea, the plagues of Passover.
Yeah, those classic examples.
And then Jesus' own life filled with acts of healing, turning water into wine, even walking on water.
So yeah, lots of ground to cover.
Exactly. Our mission in this deep dive is to explore the rationality, really, of believing in miracles from a philosophical standpoint. We're going to dig into some of the major objections that have been raised over the centuries and see how those who believe in miracles might respond.
This is really fascinating territory. When we start talking about miracles, it's useful to have a few categories in mind. Our sources today highlight two main types. First, we have what are called contingency miracles.
Contingency miracles, okay.
Now, these aren't about nature suddenly behaving in a completely new way, but rather extraordinary, almost unbelievable coincidences. You know, a sequence of highly improbable events that just happen to line up perfectly.
Okay, let's make that concrete. I think there's a great example from one of our sources.
It
follows a job application.
Yes, the Bill example. It's a good one.
Right. Picture this. A guy named Bill sends off his application to a bank. The envelope slips out of his hand, falls through a crack in the mailbox, lands on the ground. Not exactly a great start.
Definitely not ideal.
But then, out of nowhere, a gust of wind picks it up just as a pickup truck is driving by, and it blows the envelope right into the truck bed.
Okay, getting weird now.
Now get this, the truck happens to be heading downtown directly past the very bank Bill applied to.
What are the odds?
And wouldn't you know it, another little gust of wind lifts the envelope out of the truck bed and drops it onto the sidewalk right in front of the bank president's daughter.
No way.
Yeah. She recognizes the name, picks it up, and makes sure it gets to the right person. Bill gets the job.
Wow. Okay, so think about each of those events individually. The wind blowing, the truck driving by, the daughter walking past. Each one is perfectly normal.
Totally normal stuff.
There's no law of physics being broken.
Mm-hmm.
What makes this feel so extraordinary, so almost miraculous,
yeah,
is the sheer unlikelihood of all those independent events happening in that specific order to produce that particular outcome.
Right.
It's a coincidence on steroids, you know? What are the odds? Mm-hmm. Moment amplified 1,000-fold.
Right. It's that feeling of unbelievable chance taken to an extreme. Now, the second category of miracles is quite different. Violation miracles.
Ah, yes. These are the ones that really seem to involve a direct, well, breaking of the natural laws as we understand them.
Okay, yeah.
Precisely. These are the events that tend to capture our imagination and often fuel the most intense debates. Think about someone with a terminal illness suddenly being completely cured with no medical explanation, like a tumor just vanishing overnight.
Yeah, you hear stories like that.
Or imagine someone born blind, instantly gaining their sight. Even surviving a fall from a tremendous height without any serious injuries would fall into this category. These events, on the surface, seem to go against everything we know about how the natural world operates.
And when you start thinking about the rationality of believing in these kinds of events, one figure from philosophy looms large, David Hume.
Oh yeah, Hume. You can't talk about miracles in philosophy without talking about Hume.
Exactly. His book, An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, is a real landmark in this discussion. And our sources point out that his argument against miracles has been interpreted in a couple of really significant ways.
That's absolutely right. Hume is pivotal. And getting a handle on his arguments is key to understanding the whole debate. The first way his argument has been understood is what we often call his metaphysical argument, or the hard interpretation.
The hard one, okay.
This essentially argues that miracles are impossible in principle.
Okay, so what's the logic behind that? How does that work?
Well, the core idea here is that miracles, by their very definition, are seen as violations of the laws of nature.
Right, that's the definition we just discussed.
And natural laws, according to this interpretation of Hume, are absolutely uniform. They have no exceptions whatsoever. Unalterably uniform.
Okay, no exceptions.
If that's the case, then a violation, a miracle, simply can't happen. It's a logical contradiction, like trying to have a square circle.
So it's baked into the definition, but our source material also points out a pretty significant problem with this line of reasoning.
Exactly. The big problem is that it ends up being a circular argument. Well, The initial claim that the laws of nature are unalterably uniform already assumes the very thing it's trying to prove, namely, that miracles can't occur.
Ah, I see. It's assuming the conclusion in the premise.
Precisely. It's essentially defining miracles out of existence right from the start. Because of this circularity, most philosophers today who study Hume, well, they don't think this was actually the main point he was trying to make.
Which leads us to the second and arguably much more influential way of understanding Hume's argument, his epistemological argument, often called the soft interpretation.
Right, the epistemological
one. Now, this doesn't necessarily say that miracles can't happen, but rather that we're never rationally justified in believing that they have, even if they could. Just to clarify that term, epistemology is basically the branch of philosophy that deals with how we know things, right? What counts as knowledge, how justified our beliefs are.
Precisely. And Hume lays out a series of premises to support this soft argument. First, he argues that a miracle, by its very nature, is a rare event. Infrequent.
Okay, makes sense. Miracles aren't everyday occurrences.
Second, a natural law, by contrast, describes something that happens regularly, consistently. The sun rising, gravity working, etc.
Right, the norm.
Third, because of this difference in frequency, the evidence we have for regular occurrences for natural laws is always going to be greater than the evidence for rare occurrences like miracles. Simply put, we see natural laws in action all the time, while miracles are, by definition, infrequent.
So the weight of experience is on the side of natural law.
Exactly. And fourth, Hume says that wise people, well, they base their beliefs on the weight of the evidence. They go with what has more proof.
And from these premises, Hume draws his conclusion.
Exactly. His conclusion is that a wise person should never believe in miracles. Even if a miracle were to occur, the sheer weight of past experience confirming the natural law it seems to violate would always be overwhelmingly stronger, making belief in the miracle irrational.
Okay, that sounds like a pretty significant challenge to anyone who believes in miracles. A really powerful argument, actually.
It is. It's been hugely influential.
But our sources offer some really interesting responses to this line of thinking. The first one tackles Hume's focus on probability over actual evidence.
That's a crucial distinction to make. Hume is essentially saying that miracles are improbable, while natural laws are probable. But the strength of evidence isn't solely about probability.
Right. It's not just about the odds beforehand.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The source uses a great, relatable example. Rolling five of a kind in Yahtzee.
Oh, yeah, good old Yahtzee.
The odds of doing that in a single roll are incredibly low. Something like, what, 8,000 to 1? Maybe worse.
Something crazy like that, yeah. Highly improbable.
Yet many people who play Yahtzee regularly have actually seen it happen. Or maybe they've done it themselves. The low probability doesn't suddenly erase the eyewitness account when it does occur. You see the dice, you believe it, right?
Right. Just because something is highly unlikely doesn't automatically make it impossible. And it certainly doesn't mean we should dismiss credible evidence if it does happen. And the source follows that up with an even more impactful example.
Yeah, a much more serious one. Think about the 9/11 terrorist attacks. Before it happened, the idea of terrorists hijacking commercial airliners and crashing them into the World Trade Center, I mean, that was an event of extraordinarily low probability.
Unthinkable for most people.
You could have argued it was practically unimaginable based on past experience. Yet the evidence that it did happen is overwhelming and undeniable. Video footage, eyewitnesses, wreckage.
Absolutely undeniable evidence.
The extreme improbability before the fact doesn't negate the reality of the event once it occurred and was thoroughly documented. Improbability alone just isn't a solid reason to disbelieve something when strong evidence exists.
Okay, so that's one major response. Hume focuses too much on prior probability and not enough on specific evidence for a specific event.
Exactly. The second major response to Hume takes his argument a step further, suggesting that it actually proves too much.
Proves too much. What does that mean?
This critique argues that if we strictly adhered to Hume's principle of always disbelieving the highly improbable, we would have to reject many well-established historical events that were also, in their own time, incredibly unlikely.
Like what, for instance?
The source brings up the example of Joe DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak.
Ah, the Yankee Clipper. Iconic streak.
For a baseball player to get a hit in 56 consecutive games is statistically incredibly improbable, especially when you look at his performance before and after that streak. I mean, he was a great player, obviously, but that sustained level was just off the charts unlikely.
Well, it stands out even for him.
Yet, the historical evidence, The baseball records, the box scores, the eyewitness accounts, the newspaper articles from the time overwhelmingly confirms that it happened.
No serious historian doubts it.
Right. So if we were to rigidly follow Hume's logic about improbability, we'd arguably be forced to doubt even these well-documented, albeit improbable, historical events.
So the argument is, if Hume's rule makes us doubt things we know happened, maybe the rule itself is flawed.
That's the implication. It leads you to question whether the central issue is really about the possibility of miracles, or maybe it's more about our criteria for accepting extraordinary claims in general, regardless of whether they technically violate natural laws or are just extremely improbable events.
That's a really interesting way to frame it. It makes you think about what kind of standards we apply to different kinds of extraordinary claims. And then there's the third response to Hume, which points out a potential inconsistency within his own philosophical views.
Yes, this is where it gets really interesting, philosophically speaking.
What's the inconsistency?
Well, in other parts of his inquiry, Hume famously questions whether we can even know for sure that nature is uniform. He raises the problem of induction.
The problem of induction.
Yeah, basically, how can we be certain that just because the sun has risen every day so far, it will necessarily rise again tomorrow? How do we justify generalizing from past observations to future events? Hume was actually quite skeptical about our ability to prove the uniformity of nature.
Wait, so he doubted the very uniformity he relies on to argue against miracles?
Exactly. He cast doubt on our ability to definitively establish the very laws of nature that he then uses as the foundation for arguing against miracles because they'd be violations of those laws. It seems a bit contradictory, right? To question the reliability of our knowledge of natural laws in one context and then appeal to their supposed unbreakable, unalterably uniform nature in another context to dismiss miracles.
It's almost like he's saying we can't be absolutely certain the sun will rise tomorrow, but also we're absolutely certain water can't turn into wine because laws are unbreakable. There's definitely a tension there, to say the least. Wow, that's a really striking contradiction. So he's kind of undermining his own foundation for the argument.
That's certainly how some critics interpret it. It's a major point of discussion among Hume scholars. Now, Hume also puts forward some secondary arguments against belief in miracles beyond the main epistemological one.
Okay, what else did he argue?
Well, one of his points, according to our sources, is that there hasn't been sufficient testimony from intelligent, educated people to support claims of miracles.
The smart people don't see miracles argument, basically.
Kind of. His argument is essentially that if these extraordinary events really happened, surely more credible and discerning witnesses, people less prone to delusion or exaggeration, would have come forward to attest to them.
Okay. And what's the response to that?
Well, the counterargument is that actually many intelligent and highly educated individuals throughout history and in the present day have testified to experiencing or witnessing events they believe to be miracles.
Such as?
The source specifically mentions the Apostle Paul, clearly a highly educated individual in his time, trained under Gamaliel.
Right, a scholar.
And then there's the contemporary scholar Craig Keener. His massive two-volume work meticulously documents hundreds, maybe thousands, of alleged miracles from all five continents. Many of these accounts come from credible sources, including doctors and academics, and have been investigated with significant scholarly rigor. Keener's work is kind of the standard reference now.
Wow, two volumes. That's extensive.
It is. The source also points out that many contemporary physicians report events in their medical practice that, frankly, defy conventional scientific explanation. Spontaneous remissions, unexpected recoveries.
So it's not necessarily a lack of testimony from credible sources. It seems to be more about whether one finds that testimony persuasive, maybe.
That seems to be the crux of it. Another of Hume's secondary arguments is that claims of miracles tend to be more prevalent among what he terms the ignorant and uncivilized.
Oof, that sounds a bit condescending today.
It definitely reflects the biases of his time. But his reasoning appears to be that if belief in miracles is more widespread in less educated or less technologically developed societies, it suggests that these beliefs are rooted in superstition or a lack of understanding of the natural world rather than in genuine occurrences.
Okay, I get the argument, even if the language is dated. And what's the response to that particular point?
The main counterpoint is that the prevalence of a belief within a particular group of people doesn't automatically determine whether that belief is true or false.
Right. Popularity doesn't equal truth.
Exactly. Throughout history, many ideas that were eventually accepted as true by intelligent, educated people might have also been held, perhaps for different reasons or with different interpretations, by those Hume might have dismissed. The focus, the response argues, should be on the objective evidence for the miracle claims themselves, not on the demographic characteristics of those who believe them.
That makes logical sense. The truth of a claim shouldn't really hinge on who believes it, or how educated they are, or where they live.
Agreed. Finally, Hume raises the complex issue of conflicting miracle claims in rival religious systems.
This is a big one. Like, if Christianity claims miracles, but so does Islam or Hinduism or other faiths, what do we make of that?
Yes, Hume argues that since different religions have their own sets of miracle claims that often contradict each other theologically, these inconsistencies actually undermine the credibility of all such claims. Why, Hume might ask, should we give credence to Christian miracles, for example, when Hinduism or Islam also have their own seemingly miraculous events that support their own unique theological frameworks? He suggests they basically cancel each other out.
It's the idea that if one set of claims is likely false or contradicts another, it casts a shadow of doubt on all similar claims from different systems.
Yeah.
It implies they can't all be true, so maybe none are.
That's the thrust of his argument.
So how do those who believe in miracles typically respond to this challenge? It seems like a tricky one.
Our source offers several potential responses. One is simply that. Well, the miracle claims of some religions might indeed be false or misinterpreted, while the claims of one particular religion could still be genuine and reliable. The mere existence of false claims doesn't automatically invalidate all claims in that category. Think of counterfeit money. Its existence doesn't mean real money isn't real.
Okay, so some might be true, some false.
Another really interesting point that's raised is the possibility that the same God might be behind what appear to be miracles in different religious contexts.
How would that work?
Well, perhaps as a way of drawing people towards a greater understanding of the divine, even if their initial cultural or religious framework is different. The source provides the example, sometimes reported in mission contexts, of Muslims having visions of Christ and subsequently seeking out and receiving New Testaments.
That's a really fascinating angle, the idea of a universal God working in diverse ways that might transcend specific religious boundaries. Interesting. And then there's a more, well, let's say intriguing possibility that the source brings up. Gets into slightly different territory.
Indeed. The idea of demonic or counterfeit miracles.
Okay, counterfeit miracles. Tell me more.
The source shares a compelling, if rather unsettling, anecdote from a retired Baptist missionary. He apparently encountered an occult store owner who claimed to, and seemingly did, bring a dead dog back to life.
Whoa, seriously?
According to the account, the dog was described as clearly deceased rigor mortis had set in. It was bloated, but then it appeared to be alive again, although reportedly in a very disturbing and unnatural state with red eyes. The store owner apparently burned some paraphernalia afterwards.
That's creepy. What was the missionary's take?
His theological interpretation was that while satanic or other non-divine powers might be able to produce wondrous or seemingly miraculous events, deceptive signs, the true power of God lies in salvation and genuine new creation, eternal life, not just reanimation. The source even points to the biblical precedent, you know, Moses and Pharaoh's magicians in Exodus. They were able to replicate some of Moses' miracles, like turning staffs into snakes, at least initially.
Right. I remember that story. So the idea is that not all supernatural seeming events necessarily come from God.
Exactly. It implies the existence of claimed miracles, even across different faiths or from non-religious sources, forces us to grapple with the nature of truth, the source of power, and the reliability of our own discernment. We need to ask where the power comes from.
So the existence of seemingly miraculous events in other religions or even non-religious contexts doesn't necessarily disprove all miracles. It could point to different origins, some of which might not be divine in the traditional sense. It really highlights the need for careful discernment and critical thinking when evaluating such claims.
Absolutely. It suggests a more complex reality where not every extraordinary event has the same source or the same implications.
So, as we bring this deep dive into the concept of miracles to a close, we've explored the distinction between those incredible coincidences we called contingency miracles.
Like Bill's job application.
Right. And the violation miracles that seem to go against the very fabric of natural law, healings, resurrections, that kind of thing.
And we've wrestled with David Hume's very influential arguments against believing in miracles, particularly his epistemological challenge.
Yeah, and examined a range of responses, questioning his emphasis on probability, pointing out potential inconsistencies in his own philosophy, and offering counterexamples of credible testimony.
And we've also touched on the complexities that arise when we consider miracle claims from different religious traditions and the intriguing, if unsettling, possibility of what might be termed counterfeit miracles.
So here's a final thought for you, the listener, to consider. Taking into account all of these arguments and different perspectives, what kind of evidence would you personally find most compelling for believing in a miracle? Is it eyewitness testimony, scientific inexplicability, personal experience?
And also, how does the possibility of both genuine and counterfeit miracles ultimately impact your understanding of the world around you and the vast and diverse landscape of human belief systems? Does it make you more skeptical or more discerning, perhaps?
It's a question that really invites ongoing reflection, and we certainly hope this deep dive has provided you with some valuable tools and perspectives to explore it further.